Well, first of all, I'd like to welcome you to PHS, and I'm going to, before I introduce the panel, I'm not Inga, but I'm going to fill in for Inga right now until she gets here. She's on deadline, and she will be here shortly. But how many people here read Inga's piece? Okay. Tonight, we're really going to talk about that. And really, you know, what that means for the future of open space here in Philadelphia, what it means for the history of open space, what it meant for the history of open space in Philadelphia. But I really want to sort of set the stage tonight with a really quick intro and why, you know, I believe that Philadelphia is actually what I call the horticultural handbasket of the United States. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to have this job, which I think is one of the best jobs in the world as president of the Pennsylvania Horticulture Society, is this is the horticultural handbasket of the United States. And it was so funny because I usually start out my PowerPoint presentations with William Penn, five green squares, you know, everyone loved green spaces, parks were in our blood, and then Inga's article sort of was like, maybe I need to change that slide in my PowerPoint presentation and really understand and dive more into the history, and hopefully, you know, that's what we'll get to tonight. However, I do think even with that saying, the concept was great. And when is building a park for real estate or developmental purposes or capitalizing on an asset or it was a workhorse or whatever, when is that wrong? I don't know. It gave us some pretty great natural resources here in this city, and they've stood the test of time. So I'm not quite sure if it's a positive or a negative. But in my other job, before I came here, I worked for Mayor Daley in Chicago. And Chicago had a really huge burst of parks planning with Burnham and the whole lakefront plan, and then actually just sort of went away. And there wasn't this whole history there, and it was really only one section of the city, the lakefront, that actually really garnered any attention. And the interior parks, yes, the south parks were done by Olmsted and the west parks were done by Jensen, but where most of the wealthy people now live, on the north side, there's not one great, really, landscape architect or anybody that designed anything great. The most prominent park is Lincoln Park. Nobody really knows, you know, some pieces of it have been designed over time. But when Mayor Daley took office in 1989, something happened. And in 1993, it took that time in there, his first term, to really get himself in shape. And then in 1993, when I joined his administration, we came up with this concept of this great idea that, you know, landscaping and parks are pretty cheap compared to everything else that we can invest in. And it can really transform a city overnight. And over the last 20 years, Chicago has really transformed its public space. It's had a huge paradigm shift that public space became important to a city that actually public space really wasn't that important to at all. They had Daley Plaza that was created by the Daley Senior. They had the first bank plaza, the first Chicago bank plaza that was created off of a zoning regulation that was, you know, pretty sparse and no one ever used. It had a great Chagall in it, but other than that, no one even uses it. So it was really interesting to see that happen over the last 20 years. And has Philadelphia ever been in that situation? Has been in that situation? Where are we on this sort of scale of the importance of public space to our future as relevant to our past? And that's what we want to discuss tonight. And I really want to introduce, because I'm not going to talk much anymore, we're going to really introduce our panel. And first one is Pete. If you want to stand up and tell us a little bit about you have a really, really long and great history here on the open space in Philadelphia, among other things with the zoo and now with the cemetery. So, have at it.
Well, I've come back home, so to speak, in my new job at the Laurel Hill and West Laurel Hill Cemetery. It's like coming back to the park. My first real job was director of Fairmount Park back in the 80s. And I actually still have my testimony in City Council in 1987. And I read it today and I think, you know, damn it, you know, let's get going. You know, it's been frustrating to watch this great park just sit there and sort of do its work, as Inga says, as our workhorse, but we're really not taking care of it. The fellow that I succeeded at the zoo, Bill Donaldson, was a city manager in Cincinnati, and you know, he had a lot of experience in other cities, and one of his favorite sayings that I still cherish was, maintenance is the sign of civilization. And that's to me, if we can just take care of our parks and program them to be, and encourage people to use them, I think we can go a long, long way. So I'm coming full circle back here at Laurel Hill. We're making Laurel Hill part of the park. We're programming it as a park. You can jog there, you can take your dogs there, you can picnic there, you can walk up there on your way from the river. So we're making it part of the park. And I think that you know, if we can all think of our park that way, that the park is part of us and we are part of it, that's sort of where I come from.
Fantastic. Thanks. Now you're going to be in the hot seat up here.
Oh, yes,
up here. Jeannie, you want to stand up and tell us a little bit about where you're coming from?
Sure. My name is Jeannie Birch. I am a faculty member at the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of Pennsylvania and co-director of the Penn Institute for Urban Research. And we have partnered with the PHS on a wonderful conference a few years ago, which resulted in a book called Growing Greener Cities. And we focused on the kinds of things that we can do locally and citywide and regionally to make our cities more green. I am by city. I live in New York. I work in Philadelphia, so I experience two kinds, sets of different kinds of parks, and I'm very happy to be here tonight.
Welcome. So we're going to start out with a pretty simple question, but it's one that I think everyone here can, and I want you guys to all sort of answer in your head as well, and maybe in the groups you can come up with it, but. You guys, let's start with Jeannie first, and then Pete. What is your favorite park or public space in the world, and why?
Okay, I'm not going to pick one because.
Hey, it says what is your favorite park?
Because for me, park means many things. It could be a place where I get up early in the morning and go jogging in, and I like that particular park because I can go jogging. It is a place where I might want to go for lunch. I might want to take my lunch outside and go on the Penn campus and find a little nook on the Penn campus, and there's a lovely park there. Or tonight, after this discussion, I might want to go down to Rittenhouse Square and hang out there and see what's happening there. Or if I don't like that, I might go take a sneak peek at Race Pier and see what's happening there. In other words, what I'm pointing out is that I don't think there's any single one park that one can love. I think there are many parks that one experiences and loves. And I just talked about Philadelphia and a little bit by implication of New York. I haven't even talked about the rest of the world. But part of my love in traveling around the world is to go look at open spaces and experience in them. I'm sure you all do too. So anything from La Villette in Paris, which is a former slaughterhouse that has been turned into an absolutely extraordinary park, which has museums in it, it has the park itself, it has playgrounds for the immigrant children who are living nearby it. The Citroën Park, also in Paris, which is also the old Citroën factory, which has been redone. Or how about walking along the banks of the Seine? Or how about going off to Venice and being on the rivers and canals? One could even think of them as parks because they're public realm, public spaces. So I think there are many, many places in the world, and I could go on for a long time, but I would like to recommend for you, if you want to know all about parks, this beautiful book by Alex Garvin, which is encyclopedic about parks, what makes them works, how they can be planned and designed, but also how they can be financed and managed, and I think we're going to talk about that a little later as well.
Pete, same question.
Follow. I have to feel very much the same way, that it's a hard thing to answer, but I'll try. I'd say if we were to distill all the great parks into one small space, as we might know it here, Rittenhouse Square. Jane Jacobs highlighted Rittenhouse Square for a lot of reasons as a place, as a crossroads that people would come to. It's a park that demonstrates all the values of park. When you look at property values being affected by a park, it also demonstrates that it isn't necessarily a mecca for tourism. It's a place where people who live here actually use it. And it's a place with some great design on a small scale. And to me, it sort of brings together all those in one place. And like you, I could go on and on and on, all the way from the places that are hidden in the Wissahickon or the Penny Pack, to the places that my son probably drank beer.
It's
all about your mood. It's all about your mood, yeah. So
building on that, you know, what do parks mean or do for cities, and in what way do they form an image of the city, positive or negative? Can parks form an image of the city?
Absolutely, positively and negatively. I mean, I can remember in the 60s and the 70s when Central Park, the word Central Park meant danger, you can't go there, it's ugly, only, you know, it's a terrible place. And now the word Central Park takes on a whole new meaning. It is the mecca of the city. And again, not just tourists, but people who live in New York. And they've flocked there in huge numbers. Olmsted's design holds up today so beautifully I just go there just to watch people enjoy that park. It's awesome. And it sort of helps define New York City. But then you get away from there, go to Prospect Park. Prospect Park feels like where Philadelphia would like to be. It's truly a huge neighborhood park. And it's out there where people live in very large numbers and play and use it in very large numbers. Those kind of parks sort of define the whole town or a major part of the town. Here in Philadelphia, the Parkway helps define Philadelphia to a tourist. But if you live in the Northwest, the Wissahickon defines the Northwest. If you live in South Philly, FDR Park hopefully defines you in South Philly. So I think it depends on where you live, because the park begins to define where you live very much day to day.
I think a park makes a place livable, particularly an urban place. We can't just be on cement sidewalks. We can't just be living in our little apartments or our little houses. We need to get out. We need to see nature. There's something intrinsic in our hearts and in our minds and our souls about being close and touching nature. And we don't have to go to the country to do that. Perhaps some of the most beautiful scenes that one might see is the contrast with being in a park, being close to nature, seeing the butterflies, the birds, the flowers, the plants, smelling the green grass, and so forth. And then in the background, you see this wonderful skyline. I'm thinking of Belmont Plateau and being in the middle of Fairmount Park and looking out and seeing that skyline of Philadelphia. What is more exciting, right? And being in the middle of this beautiful natural precinct and then looking out and seeing this great city in the background. The park frames it. It gives you, it provides lungs for the city itself. And it provides sort of spiritual solace and recreation and all of those personal things that we all like. Parks also give identity to cities. You think of any city in your repertoire, and I bet you can name the park that's part of that city, the emblematic park. Parks give value to property in cities. And we know this has been, my colleague Susan Wachter has done a fantastic study here in Philadelphia about that, but worldwide there is no question that property located near well-maintained parks gives value to that property. So we have sort of the health lungs aspect, we have the economic aspect, we have the social aspect, we have a political aspect to parks as well. And this was very much in the minds of Frederick Law Olmsted and Calvert Box when they were doing the parks that they were doing. Their vision was, and perhaps of William Penn as well, was that the park is a place where people of different economic and social classes will cluster and be together and be part of the civitas, part of the city. They're recreating together, they're walking together, they're seeing each other, and the park provides the neutral ground for this to happen. So we have economic value, aesthetic value, social value, contrasting value, the urban-rural. We have all sorts of things that parks do for cities, and they're just spectacular, and they do them right.
If building on that question, if an image of a city is shaped by some of its public spaces, what are the iconic images that Philadelphia would have based on its public spaces?
I think
This is an unrehearsed question.
The rivers and the creeks. I mean, to me, if you're in the neighborhood, it's the creeks or cricks. But in the city, in the bigger part of the city, it's really the rivers. I mean, that really defines Philadelphia, the Schuylkill and the Delaware. The Schuylkill, of course, has done a much better job of acting as a park than the Delaware has, but someday that can happen on the Delaware as well. That and probably the Parkway, which mm-hmm. was really man-made. The rivers were not man-made, and we're taking advantage of that. So I'd say those are probably the most iconic parts of our parks.
What system. About Independence, around Independence Hall? And those, that, to me, is also iconic. That's Philadelphia.
The list goes on.
Yes, exactly.
Boathouse Row,
absolutely. There's no other place in the world that has a Boathouse Row like that. No place. And it's beautiful all seasons.
And what other things besides public spaces, what are other Philadelphia iconic images that would complement the open space? Would it be, say, City Hall?
I was just thinking of William Penn.
William Penn on top?
Right. Exactly. The skyline.
It's the new skyline.
The new skyline with Comcast.
The new skyline. Right.
And the history. I mean, the strong, strong sense of history. Imagine. Being able to walk on those streets, the Benjamin Franklin walked on. We can do that, I mean, that's pretty heady. Where else can you do this?
You know, this brings up a really good sort of commentary and question about the importance of good design in public spaces. Because a lot of the iconic images we just pointed out were things that were well designed and they were thought about. They were created out of local material. They're something that have become beloved. Now, how many of you love the cement block recreation centers that are in a lot of our parks as buildings that now have murals painted on them and stuff like that? They aren't loved buildings. How important is design to a public space and integrating it into the community and over the centuries making it a beloved icon? Is it important?
It's fundamental. I mean, if you're comparing rec centers to, let's say, Smith Playground, go back to the Parkway and the Swan Fountain. I mean, one of our projects at the Swan Fountain a few years ago, was to reclaim the art of that fountain. And for years and years and years, it had these little, sputtering little pieces of water coming out. And so we decided to sort of reclaim that artistic vision of the design of the fountain so that the whole arch is, and it was dramatic. On the negative side, Dilworth Plaza just doesn't work as we know it. It was a terrible idea. People don't want to go there. The new proposed design for the plaza, it's awesome. I just can't wait to see it. It's going to really bring people back to the plaza. I mean, good design has to make people want to be there. Bad design looks sterile, and for some reason, if only two people are there, you're not going to go. But if 50 people are there, you're going to want to come and join them. Good design really encourages use.
There was an unfortunate period in architectural history. Here's Inger.
Speaking of design,
perfect time. Come up, get yourself comfortable. Very unfortunate period in architectural design periods, which was the international style in the 1940 post-war period, which Dilworth Plaza is a memory or a symbol. And at that time, the architects really didn't think of people using these plazas. They were really worried about creating sculptural places. And symbolic of that is in many of those spaces that were designed in that period, there are seats. But do you think those seats are movable? No, they're solid because they're pieces of sculpture. That's what the architect, master architect, envisioned is what this space should be. It should not be touched by people because I, the architect, have told you what to do. But if you look at some of the work that William H. White did, Holly White did, in looking at public spaces, it's a wonderful movie, The Social Life of Small Urban Places, that he made in the 1960s and 70s, which was a real condemnation of some of these designs. He showed how human beings actually take these designs and shape them themselves. They find ways to make them usable. And then from that, he articulated the kinds of principles that we need for designing small public spaces in urban areas, having movable seats, having food, having a water element, perhaps, oriented so that there's sun, a variety of things, so that the spaces will become usable and inviting to people. And that's what we've learned in the periods that we're looking at now. What I'm looking forward to, and I'll stop talking because they have things to talk about, but is what is going to happen prospectively as we think about what the Water Department is doing with its water retention plan that is for all of Philadelphia. And there's a good deal of greening that's going to occur in spaces that you wouldn't expect. School playgrounds, parking lots, gutters along the sidewalks, reclaiming streams, all sorts of things which have purposes that are very utilitarian, which is draining rainwater, relieving the combined sewer outflow system that the city has, many cities have, but will end up in providing for a much greener, more beautiful public realm and little mini parks and unexpected places that people will use.
Is that not what Olmsted, one of his plans for the for Boston was drainage, also Newark was as well?
It's 100%. I mean, the Emerald Necklace was done in order to relieve flooding. And interestingly enough, about 5 years ago, there was this awful plant that had taken over. Have you heard about the horrible Phragmites? Horrible Phragmites. Phragmites cannot be pulled out. Phragmites have to be ripped out, burned, and taken away. And the Phragmites had invaded the Emerald Necklace such that the drainage capacity of the Emerald Necklace wasn't working anymore, and the office buildings in Boston were being flooded. And so the Parks Department there embarked on an enormous, expensive program to get rid of the dreaded Phragmites.
With that, as Inga sort of points out in her article, is that design hasn't always been the top priority in Philadelphia and its public spaces. And just let's have why is that, and how? I mean, you might want to give a little history there for this one.
Well, I think part of the reason that design hasn't been so much a part of public spaces in Philadelphia is because there's never enough money. And to get good design, you need to spend a little money. And as I noted in my article, that although William Penn left the city this gift of five squares, he didn't provide an endowment, or he didn't provide for the landscaping of these parks. He just said, here are five nice blocks, which was great. But so without a design, people treated them very badly. They treated them as waste ground, as places to dump things. It wasn't until 1820 that the city, came up with the money to give them a shape and form. So I think this, theme follows through history in Philadelphia, is this failure to provide enough money to really make good designs to really shape these public spaces. Now, of course, in modern times, it's often said that it's easier to get money for capital improvements than for maintenance. So that's sort of the opposite problem, where the city might spend a vast amount of money designing a public space. Like, we can think about the plazas around City Hall, which, when they were built, I'm sure an awful lot of money was spent on all that granite in Dilworth Plaza and in Love Park. You might not think that's good design, but certainly a lot of money was spent on it. I think part of the problem is money, part of it is sensibility, part of it is, part of the problem, I think, is how people think these spaces ought to be used. And we know during sort of the worst times for cities, when spaces were designed defensively, a lot of money might have been spent on the design, but they weren't spent in a way to make these public spaces usable.
Any other?
On the issue of money, I think we really have to understand how valuable this asset is. And when we think about, is there enough money? Yes, there is enough money. We have a $3 billion city budget. The park budget is about 15, which is what it was in 1987. and it was way too small then. And you think on a per capita basis, it costs about the same to fund the park per capita as it does for a person to go to the movies one night. That's it. I mean, so it's just our priorities, and it's, I think, politically almost becoming popular to pronounce that we want to invest in our parks, but we're not quite there yet. And I think we need to give another couple of jabs to say, you know, the citizens of this city believe it's important, it's a priority, and it's more of a priority than a lousy $7 or $8 per capita. I mean, we should be putting, you know, three times that into the parks, and you wouldn't notice the difference in the city budget, but you would know a heck of a difference in livability of Philadelphia, a heck of a difference. So there is enough money.
I think cities have to be ingenious as well. In times of stress, park budgets are always the first thing to go. And I think even though Philadelphia has a very substantial budget, it is a budget under stress. And I think we need to have backstops for, not substitutes, but backstops to supplement the budget and to be very ingenious about that. There's no one solution. Some very beloved parks can have conservancies. That doesn't mean that the park itself is going to be privatized. It just means that people have taken interest and are willing to dedicate some funding to help that park be maintained. Certain parks can, certain parklands can have very carefully selected concessions and franchise information sources that can help fund those parks. Again, you have to have the balance between the parkland and what franchise and concession you might give. Very, very careful about that, but there's certainly ways to raise revenue around those kinds of things. And I think it's a nuanced program that one must think about. There's certainly public support is at the base, but there are other ways to find sources of support. Last week, I just was at the Central Park Luncheon, which in 1982 started out with about 75 people, and they thought they were really lucky when they raised $50,000. Do you know how much they raised last week? 1,300 people, $3 million to support that one park. Now, it's a very beloved, it's a densely developed place and so forth, but all I'm saying is you can start small, and you can build that support, build that love, and you can find ways to supplement the public sector.
Jean, real quick, building on that, and like you, in New York, there's a debate going on with this privatization, we say, or the concessions, that it really helps the, it's creating a 2 to 3 tiered park system. You have the have-nots and you have the haves when you have parks. That, you know, the Central Park, you know, it's one of the wealthiest places in the country with all these people around it that maintain it and love it. How, and it's something, you know, it's an interesting conversation that's going on in New York about that. And I just wonder, do you know anything about that, and what are your thoughts on that, and anybody else can?
Well, I think actually, you know, if we could move away from Central Park, because it's kind of a special case,
yeah.
But Prospect Park isn't really a special case. I mean, it's a huge park in Brooklyn, surrounded by some upper class folks with money, and a whole lot of people who are of much lower means, who live on the other side of the park. And the city doesn't share there. The city does fund the park to quite a fair degree, and they also are very good at raising private funds with the Friends Group. So there you have a really good balance between private support augmented by the city and vice versa. And what we're doing here, last year the Parks and Rec Department raised $15 million, which isn't bad,
mm-hmm.
I think the year before. but what I fear is that if we think we're gonna raise money on the backs of donors, we better be ready to do our share as a public, on the public side, because pretty soon the donors will get weary. But the donors will step in and add dollars to your park, but they're not gonna do it by themselves. So it's really a mutually reinforcing system for Philadelphia, I think, that could work. Chicago's a different...
Yeah, so I was just going to say, let's contrast that with Chicago,
yeah.
Which in the 1890s, you know, created the state created a taxing authority that allowed park districts and forest preserve districts to levy their own taxes. Now, I just want to preface that a lot of people here in Philadelphia and also in New York think that that's automatically going to get you a good park system. Chicago had the dregs of all park systems in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It was the dumping ground for you name it in the political world, and that's where it happened. And the term park district actually meant more managing parking garages than it did managing landscapes in the public space. They are the largest parking provider in the city of Chicago, the park district is, all the around the Grant Park garages and all of that stuff. So it was a huge turn to make that happen. So just having a dedicated funding stream like they have in Chicago really doesn't necessarily buy you a good park system. So, you know, with that, you know, we've got the New York model where it's a lot of private money, organizations doing that. You have Chicago where the mayor that leaves, Mayor Daley, was like, once you walk out your door, I'm in charge. It's like, you know, that's the public realm is the city's responsibility, and your taxes should go to pay for that. To, you know, other cities that are sort of bifurcated. Let's talk a little bit about that, and where do we lie as a city here in Philadelphia? I know people are pushing for that special tax, and they think it would help. Is that something that's good? Should that energy be wasted there? Or should we, you know, continue down the path of like Rittenhouse Square and Washington Square and Franklin Square with some of these private entities that are raising funds for maintenance and programming dollars?
Well, I'm right now coming out on the side of not pushing a special tax. I just think it's a tough environment to do that. And I think the advantage that our parks have is that as a percentage of the total budget, to make a shift in favor on the public side of supporting the parks to double what we're doing would be not that hard politically. It shouldn't be that hard politically. And then empowering, you know, the commissioner, Mike DeBerdinas, who can do a great job at this. The new commission, I'm the chair of the Revenue Enhancement Committee.
No, so you're the man.
Oh, you've got to do this.
We're just an advisory group. I'm powerless, you know. But I think we can, you know, we really can. In combination, we can do a much better job of getting more out of our concessions and leases and serve the public better than we have. If we can only have the city stop discouraging that, sort of get out of our own way, then I think we can, you know, also continue.
Does the city discourages that because the money goes back to the general fund
if
and it's not held?
If you want to be a vendor in the city or in the park.
Gotcha, paper, gotcha.
It's hard. I mean, you know. And truth is, most of the concessions in the park are inherently not very profitable. You know, the small food stands and things like that. So they're there as much for service as they are to make money. Now, there are some few places where there's some money to be made. Some of the leases, there's money to be made. The golf courses and things like that. You know, there are places where, if we do it well, there is some money to be made, and I think we can just do that better. But
getting smarter about it.
You know, the law department, I don't want to say, it's like, oh my God.
What about, have you thought about regional alliances, in terms of thinking, I think putting a tax on Philadelphia is not a great idea, but maybe your friends in the suburbs might. I mean, they have parks too, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, getting a larger coalition of people behind open space.
Well, a lot of suburbanites are using our parks every day, on the weekend, you go anywhere, and half the cars that are kids in these parks are from the suburbs, many of whom pay other kinds of taxes to Philadelphia, or in some way care about Philadelphia. I can imagine as a fundraiser, again, if the city was doing its part, maybe once a season, spring, summer, fall, and winter, we take a day, and we get a bunch of volunteers, and we have them at the entrance. You know how firemen are there with the buckets in the streets? We could just do the same thing at the entrances to all these parks.
Have a flower pot.
And this is your day to come in and just give whatever you feel like. And, you know, again, if at $7 per capita now, if someone gave $10 on that day, it would be huge, wouldn't it? So, I mean, I could imagine doing something like that. And a lot of suburbanites, I bet, would throw a little bit in that bucket.
Where everyone's going to wear QR codes, and then, you know, once you cross into a park, it'll know if you're a city resident or not, it'll charge you or something like that. Okay, so let's talk about one other question here, and really this is the role of economic development and parks, and sort of where that lies, and it's the question is, what role should parks play in fostering economic development in the community? Should parkland be considered untouchable for development, or are there times when development is acceptable in parks? And I know Philadelphia has a long history of these questions going on, much like other cities. Inga, do you want to?
Sure, Drew. Obviously parks make land more, make real estate more valuable. William Penn recognized that. People who live around Rittenhouse Square know that. During the last decade, during the whole condo boom, it was really interesting to watch where developers wanted to build their high-rise towers, and they wanted to build them fronting parks for a couple reasons, because people like to have open space, but they knew that if they built a high-rise facing a park, that the views would never be blocked. So those were the most attractive locations, and the waterfront and all of this. And I think that's absolutely fine. And that's a good reason to have parks, because they do enhance the value of real estate in the city and make it desirable. But at the same time, what we've seen for several decades now, I guess, in Philadelphia is a feeling that we have so much parkland, and it must really gnaw at some public officials who just know that if we could just sell off some of this land, we could make a lot of money and do stuff with it, and it's just an irresistible temptation. And we saw this with Brougham Park up in the northeast, where Fox Chase Cancer Center, which is a perfectly fine institution, but they wanted to expand. They didn't want to build up. They decided they wanted to build horizontally, and so they were going to, they asked the city for 20 acres, a third of Brougham Park, and the city said okay. And then we saw just this past fall with duck boats, when they were in a jam because of the accident on the Delaware River. They wanted to go put their boats in the Schuylkill, and to do that, they needed to really seriously encroach on the Schuylkill Banks Park, which is one of the most successful new public parks the city has added in years. Both of those things were stopped thanks to public opposition. There's other examples. Some of them get into some kind of gray area, like the Microsoft High School. In Parkside, you could say that's a good public use to have a high school. It's hard to find big sites for schools, so the city gave the school a piece of the park. But to me, this is really dangerous territory, because it means that parkland is fungible. It's a resource. It's something that you can trade. For money, for something else, and it's always going to be a temptation. So I think it reflects a way of thinking about parks that we don't value them just as parks, just as places where people can escape from the pressures of daily life, where they can go to relax. And so I think that the economic development aspect has to be kept in perspective.
I think it's interesting, specifically here in Philadelphia, with this economic development question, with just the huge amount of vacant land that the city has that overlays the park system as well, that parks are still viewed, they're easier to be built on than dealing with the vacant land, some of the vacant land issues. Yeah.
Also, I think going back on the economic development side, the bigger issue is using the park as an investment for residents. The study that was done by Trust for Public Places, Trust for Public Land, documented that if we had all good or better parks, that the property values would increase by $680 million. Now that's real money. So what it tells me is, again, investing in care of the parks is probably the most important economic development action that we could take. The example I always used before was, if you're an individual and your personal economic development requires getting a job, among the first things you're going to do is maybe get a haircut, or you know, make some investment, you know, in your hygiene or something that doesn't cost much. You know, you're not going to necessarily go to Harvard, invest in a Harvard education, but you can go out and get a haircut. And we could give ourselves a haircut here in Philadelphia for a lot less money than we think. And so that's the kind of economic development we ought to be looking at.
I think there's sort of a nuanced approach, again, that you have to think about. I entirely agree with what Inga said about you should never give up an inch of parkland for anything. But sometimes parkland is located near an institution where there is an imperative with regard to expansion. If, in the rarest of occasions, that needs to be taken, then you cannot take it without compensating with equal amounts of park or more parkland in another place, either adjacent to where you've taken it or in a desirable place, so that you're not having a negative piece to the parks, that you are compensating and replacing any parkland that you might take, and that it has to be better than what you took. All right, so in the rarest of occasions that that might happen, that's one idea. The other idea is we should really be thinking about land banking. There's this huge amount of vacant land that's abandoned, that is not in city ownership, should be in city ownership, should be put into land banks, should be thought about in terms of different kinds of open space. Maybe it's urban agriculture for a while, maybe it's community gardens, maybe it's creating ribbons of parks in the areas that we think that will be appropriate for redevelopment, for housing and so forth, using the vacant land to create the open space and parklands to achieve the economic development that's needed.
So really it's back to the future, William Penn, creating the squares, creating
Absolutely.
Different kinds of land to spur.
Very thoughtfully and carefully.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to switch gears now, and we're going to turn it over to you all. And if you have questions, we would, you know, any of these wonderful people up here would love to answer them about this topic. If you don't have a question but would just like to get something out of your chest, that's okay as well. And I'm going to throw a couple questions out to you that if you don't really have a question to ask, if you want to answer a couple. One being, what would be one thing that Philadelphia could do to improve its parks and public space? One thing that we could do. And also, and this needs to have we all understand the question here, but everything that's safe to say in a public meeting. Do you have a fond memory of a park or open space? And if so, has it had an impact on your life? So that's a question we're throwing out to the audience. If no one has questions, please stand up and answer those, and we'll take questions for our panelists. Yes, sir.
I'm pleased to see it. One of the nice things about parks is like the serendipitous aspect of bumping into something you didn't expect to see. And I live near Chestnut Street, and they're redesigning the Chestnut Street Best Park. And I'm just wondering, what's that all about? And why did it fail the first time around? And is it going to be any better this time?
I don't know if it failed. I think it was run down and it needed some maintenance. I will say, however, it has been redesigned to be a little less attractive to the homeless, to people sleeping there. And the gate, I don't know if you noticed, the gate was, the decorative part of the gate was, they switched sides. Some people are pretty upset about the way that was done. And that's so it can be closed, locked more effectively. But I think inside it seems, except for a few changes at the entrance, it's pretty much the same. And I think the
traffic flow is not going to be improved then?
Improved through that park?
No, because it was virtually nil before.
What you mean? People don't. You're saying people don't.
No, people didn't use it because it was dominated by the homeless.
Well, maybe
it was
thought
a scary spot.
Yeah. I love that park.
So do I.
I love that park a lot, and whenever I can make a cut through there, I do. You know, for a while they weren't opening it till like 11 o'clock in the morning, which is really terrible.
Who owns it?
That Center City District now.
Is it the Center City District? Okay, it was used to be owned by the Penger Dell Council. Center City District did the improvements there.
What's interesting was I was asking someone when I first moved here, I was asking someone on the street about that park, and someone said that it really started when the building behind it put that.
The baffle.
The
baffle.
Up, and because then you couldn't even there, you know, you even look through and you couldn't even see where it took you or anything like that, and it sort of put the nail in the coffin. I think was what someone said. It was interesting.
Pete made the point early on about how the city's budget for the park in constant terms declining for 30 years. Yet when I look around the city, many of the parks are nicer than they were 25, 30 years ago. Rittenhouse Square, Washington Square, which is now part of the Park Service, Franklin Square, which is now an amusement park basically, and Logan Square. And I'll even count Center Square, where City Hall's had its entire exterior envelope restored over the last decade. Those five parks look together better than they probably did 30 years ago. And I know a lot of that has to do with private investment with groups like the Center City District and PHS, who's also worked very hard in the neighborhoods of the city. And I just wonder if city government has sort of passively ceded control of its parks and open space maintenance to a large extent to other people.
Well, that has happened. I mean, I think the public-private partnerships have helped a lot. But you know, once you get beyond the places that are easy to have partnerships with, we don't do so well. You know, Hunting Park, there's a struggle to with the Conservancy. The Park Conservancy is trying to take on Hunting Park, but that's a pretty daunting task for them at this stage. So the city's going to have to do a lot more there. So a public-private partnership at Rittenhouse or in Center City is a lot easier than, let's say, Hunting Park. So that's where the city's going to have to, you know, step up and do more.
And have other cities done better with those outlying neighborhood parks, would you say?
New York has. You know, you get into the outlying, and there actually is a foundation, I'm forgetting the name of it, that actually, who was it?
It was the Parks Foundation.
That puts up money just for the other parks.
It was money from the New York Times.
Was it the New York Times? Mm-hmm. Or Lionel? Oh, yeah. I think there the city does a better job that way. Or in cities where they have special taxes, and of course then it gets spread around more evenly. But where you depend on public-private partnerships, then you're also going to have to go to the city to take care of the places that doesn't work so well, or where it's a lot harder.
I think cities, even like Atlanta, which people just, you know, always snicker when you say Atlanta, but. You know, they have they figured out these public-private partnerships that happen in communities. They've figured out, you know, they don't really cut the park budget. They've just redirected to the other parts of the city that are not able to form those public-private partnerships. So it's really interesting, and I think Shirley Coleman, when she was mayor, started that. I don't know if that's continuing under the new mayor there or not, but it was a very interesting sort of thing. So it's not like savings. You know, a lot of cities are like, oh, I got a public-private partnership, and it's savings, so it's going to go by the bottom line and that type of stuff.
If I'm not mistaken, St. Louis has a Metropolitan Parks District as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if you go to Forest Park, which I did a few years ago,
beautiful.
It's an amazing place.
Beautiful.
Yes.
Right.
It is.
Yeah. Having active citizens is very important, particularly in neighborhoods. Citizens vote, and they let their city council people know. Having those kinds of, they may not, particularly in less affluent neighborhoods, they may not have the ability to raise the kinds of funds that the affluent neighborhoods do, but they have the power of the vote. And so the degree that they're organized, and they can rally some support and resources to their public spaces.
Yes.
So going on what Ingo was saying earlier about maybe the city's not prioritizing the parks and there's not enough money, or it's a sector where maybe we're not prioritizing it, but what will it take for the city to
You know, just what I was listening to Drew.
Sure, I was just interested in how maybe we can get the city to start reprioritizing parks.
So when I was listening to Drew talk about Mayor Daley in Chicago, it was really obvious that what Philadelphia needs is a cheerleader for parks, a high-ranking public official, probably the mayor, to just talk about parks all the time, to go to parks, to be seen in parks, to make that a top issue, and to you know, twist the arms of wealthy people and corporations to give money. I think another thing that the city needs, and we talked a bit about conservancies supporting parks, but there are several conservancies in the city for specific parks, and one sort of broad Fairmount Park Conservancy. Well, altogether, they only raised $12 million, I think, last year. That's not very much money for a city of 1.5 million in a metropolitan area of over 5 million. 12 million is really nothing. And so you have to ask the question, why can't these conservancies raise more money? Is it because they don't have the professional fundraising staff? They're not skilled at raising money? Is it the corporate culture that exists here? I mean, I'm sure the reasons are very complicated, but I think having a cheerleader in City Hall would help that effort of the private fundraising, as well as, you know, prioritizing the city parks in the city's own budget. And then I think it even extends beyond that because, you know, Paul talked about some improvements around City Hall at Dilworth Plaza. Well, that money comes from a federal grant. So you have to have the city go after these federal and state grants and other grants. So, again, you need direction, policy direction from the top to tell various city agencies to pursue the money that's out there.
But on the happy note, you did reconstitute your parks department, and I think that's really important. And that position, that appointed position, can help create that leadership. You have a mayor who supported a Greenworks plan, of which there is a piece that is part parks, and you have the water department's plan. You've got a lot of pieces that are in play, so don't get impatient. I think it's going to happen.
Yes, sir.
I like Mr. Hoskins' concept of a haircut. Although you've got to get more than one haircut.
Well, yes. That's right.
Not if you're mean.
It grows back, just like the carpet. That's right.
But what I want to ask is something a little related to that. Paul Levy, in one of his columns a while ago, identified about half a dozen large pieces of vacant land in Center City, like the land next to the Blue Cross on Market Street, like the land at 20th and Walnut right across from Rittenhouse Square. These are all pieces of land that I think are crying out for us to do something with them. And they're not getting done. Why? I mean, they're privately owned. I'm sure people are worried about liability and all sorts of other things. But that seems like an area where the city could give itself a haircut very readily.
Well, I got Inga's article on the 22nd Street and Market, the Peep Show place. That was the one. That could use a park, yeah. the one at 20th, you know, that's pretty. That might be a stretch. I mean, that's pretty valuable real estate.
Let me just
the Peep Show's value.
The Peep Show.
What I'm thinking about is not necessarily long-term parks, but temporary uses.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
For instance, that would be a great place for
a
sculpture
festival. How about a pop-up park, like a pop-up store?
That's a great idea.
How about your Reading Viaduct? Mm-hmm. Boy, is that a resource.
That's not the same as a vacant lot right in Center City.
Well, but think of the resource that it would be if you could get that off the ground.
Back in the bag.
I'm one of those suburbanites. Which I pay to get into. I would like to know what parks all these suburbanites are going into?
Oh, my goodness. Get on the Wissahickon Trail.
The boathouses.
Any of the major trails.
The boathouses.
Boathouses, good, yeah.
Yeah, the boathouses are dominated by suburban colleges and high schools.
Yeah.
I think the ball fields.
The boathouse row is pretty heavily suburban, and all the major trails.
Mm-hmm.
You go up to the top of the Pennypack, or the Wissahickon, or FDR Park, and all the people who work at law firms and play softball after work, pardon?
Those people are paying taxes if they work here.
But they might be suburbanites. I mean, the point was you were saying, what about suburbanites? They could be suburbanites who either work in the city, or just come here on their bikes, or whatever. Yeah. Oh, no. No, we're glad to have them.
River Drive.
Oh,
right here.
River Drive,
yeah. In order to have a cheerleader at City Hall, I guess you need to educate the cheerleader for the cheering floor. I'm familiar with the parks down in Center City, because I've been coming down Center City ever since I was a child, and enjoy just walking up and down the Chestnut, the Walnut, and, you know, Market, and it's a beautiful walk, because there are things to see. I'm not one for just going out in the park and just walking. And I'm thinking of danger of parks also, okay? But it would be nice to have a little chat book with a picture of all these parks that you're talking about, with the history of these parks, of why they were created, because I really don't know if they had identification markers at the park, or why this park was important. And then maybe people in the city will become a little bit more interested and brainstorm of what we can use these parks for besides just sitting in the park. And not all people are into parks, and not all people are into nature. But I do know that Fairmount Park used to attract a big, large group of people out there. I guess you can equate it to like the 60 Bubbin kind of music out there. Well, if you talk to some of the African-American people in the community, they'll tell you what they used Fairmount Park for. They used to have concerts out there in the park that were free, and people enjoyed congregating out there, and it just stopped, I guess, after the 70s, you know. And
lots of stuff happened in the
70s. Yeah, right. You saw people walking out there. Now you don't, you know.
Philly's about 60% row houses, or 65 or 7, something like that, with very small yards. So the park is the yard.
Yes, sir.
Well, I have a comment, U.S. for a life-changing experience.
Ah. Oh. It doesn't have to do with the 70s loving thing, that doesn't. Okay.
1999, 2000, I had the opportunity to photograph Rittenhouse Square early morning in a snowstorm. And it opened me up to Philadelphia. Because it reminded me of 50s photographs of Central Park that I'm a photographer. And from that day, I just started photographing Philadelphia. It's parks and everything else that opened me up to the architecture, and I've been photographing it since. I grew up in South Philadelphia, and I did not look at the city that way. I looked at it from where I grew up, and as another part of the city, rather than as a total. So that's the life-changing thing. You mentioned the mayor, you mentioned city council. Who on city council should we vote for that supports the park?
we're gonna get a pass on that one.
You talk about a lot of existing parks. Well, I live on the outskirts. I live right along the Wissahickon, which is right there. But I deal with a lot of people coming in that live in areas that have no parks, a lot of urban flight. You talk about abandoned buildings and abandoned areas. They would love to have a park. Access to a park is difficult. If you want to come down to Fairmount, it's like the L, two buses and a 10 block walk. Parks and Recreation and Fairmount have merged. What are we going to see change in the urban areas?
Well, actually, that's going to be a good story. I think that Mike and the new department is working pretty hard to redesign several of the rec centers and parks outside of the the big green areas, a lot of re-greening. The green plan, I think, is gonna make quite a difference. And you know, the partner there with the water department, the planning commission, I think there's a strong emphasis and a very good emphasis to make parks and rec centers as new parks more accessible to people who don't have them. That's a high priority, and it's going to happen, I think.
And this is the desire. This is imperative to add 500 more acres to the park system in the neighborhoods that don't have parks. If you go to the Penn Practice website, there is a plan, a series of maps that would show you some of the recommendations for actions there.
You know, there are 65, I think, now 67 pocket parks in the city. Every Philadelphian is within 1 mile of Fairmount Park. It's not just along the rivers. They're all over the city. But now, again, you mentioned about having communities get involved and maintain them. I mean, you wouldn't want to go into the bottom, but look at the neighborhoods around them. The demographics of the city are one of the major problems.
We're going to break into groups, but one thing I like to thank you for this dialogue and sort of end on, you know, we in this group, it sort of felt like, you know, Philadelphia needs to be better. And, you know, it's not any different in any other city. Every city talks about itself this way, or else we wouldn't be striving to be the best city, the greenest city, have the best parks. I'm going to tell you a little story. When I came here in 1998, Paul Levy invited Mayor Daley and I to come here and talk to the Center City District in 1998. We were sitting around Rittenhouse Square at that time, and this is after a tour of the city. And Mayor Daley leaned over to me and he said, "God, if Chicago only had the natural resources that this city has, it would be the best city in the country." I'm going to leave with that. I'm going to turn it over to get you going on the groups, and then we'll come back. Thanks so much. Let's give a round of applause to our panel.
So now we continue the conversation and give everyone in the room a chance to participate. Positioned around the room, there are some people prepared to be facilitators of some small groups, and we'd like to just give you a chance to add on to the conversation of the panel, to generate some ideas for the encyclopedia. Someone asked, could we have histories of our parks? And yes, we can. And at the end of the groups, we're going to ask each group to give us one new idea to add to the panel discussion already. So if our panel, our group facilitators will stand up so we know who you are. Okay. And it looks like, Melissa, maybe you could come up a little more into the center of the room. So if you'll circle chairs around where you see discussion facilitators, we can get some more conversation going. Just for about 15 more minutes.
I do have it. Yeah. Right. Even though it's custom.
My name is Nicole. I live at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. Our group had a great discussion tonight. We actually have three folks.
That she works for us.
Who's writing these down? Somebody writing these down? Are you writing these down, Charlotte?
At first, our group talked about traffic within parks, specifically Fairmount Park and Kelly Drive, and how sometimes traffic through the park can really take away from some of the beauty, and we suggested shutting down Kelly Drive and turning it into bike lanes, turning it into more walking paths throughout the park that would really enhance the public recreation. Another point that we brought up was how Independence Mall is a great park that seems just aimed at tourists, and how it seems a little bit disconnected from locals who live around that area. And our third point that we talked about was dog parks, something that didn't come up in the panel discussion, and how we have more and more dogs in the city, but they need a place to go, and how there is this idea that, not in my backyard, you know, nobody wants to see the dog park, but it is needed, and it is something that needs to be considered when we're creating new public.
Gwen, let's hear from your group.
There were also a lot of great points brought up in our group discussion. I'll mention one that Janet actually suggested, which was not covered tonight. The fact of not only for residents, you know, within the city, but also for a lot of tourists that come to Philadelphia, there's not a kind of a horticultural garden or center within the city, or easily accessible from points within Center City. Unlike other places, you know, in the nation, Philadelphia lacks that.
Thank you very much. March, a horticultural center in the city. Let's hear from Randall's group.
Okay, thanks. It was a very spirited discussion in this room, and we're only allowed one. one idea that seemed to really energize people was, how do you make the parks known? And the key word there is plural, parks, not just focusing on one area. There's 63 of these parks, for example, and suggested that perhaps one way to promote parks is literally to promote parks with tours. That would, if we had such basic things as maps that pointed out where the parks are, accessibility, the histories of the suggested parks, and even setting up through tour organizations, and perhaps even working through the tourism organization itself, of making parks destination points. And not just focusing on one area, but also then consolidating the information for people both inside and outside of the city so they can learn about parks. And basically, we have resources. We just don't know about these resources. How do we help people find out about these resources and they can use these resources?
Thank you very much. Jennifer?
Speak up just a little more.
We talked about a lot of things as well. I think sort of inspired by the gentleman here from South Philly that said, you know, didn't really feel much ownership of the parks until later growing up in the neighborhood. You talked about how to affect the sort of fundamental attitude change that we don't, it seems like we consider parks a luxury, and this applies especially to maybe more marginal or blighted neighborhoods that maybe the park should be considered a luxury. Maybe it should also be one of the fundamental quality of life things. It shouldn't be delayed until other problems are solved. There are other solutions that should be part and parcel of it. And how do we make that happen? Is that where we really need to go step in?
Thank you, Melissa. And Carla.
So we have about 8 or 10, which I will formally present. But one. To engage with the school district and the system to really make parks important to people at all age levels, specifically really engaging with children and through them their parents through environmental education and through experiential playtime in parks. Also to get children out there planting and really make them vested from an early age.
Thank you. Howard.
We must have been overhearing your group because schools came up very centrally in what we were doing. But I'll amplify by saying that there was a little tension in our group between the idea of a cheerleader at the top, the mayor, because that was certainly a lot of interest in that, seeing the mayor embrace this, and more of a grassroots effort. And specifically, Gandhi came up saying, if my people were ahead of me, I better get in front of them. But to amplify the schools, I think the idea was really calling for the progressive area, that schools can be agents for change in neighborhoods. They can encourage their kids as part of the social capital of the city to become active in their neighborhood cleanup and activities. The schools can use their playgrounds as areas for a variety of different purposes. And that there ought to be energy audits and in the schools with kids being part of them. And finally, that over time, we might think of something like a History Day activity permeating the schools around the environmental issues that take into account not just parks, but the whole environment in terms of trees and other kinds of plants that animate or at least modify the built environment, the lungs of the city going back again to the 19th century.
Thank you very much. Well, what we hope is that the Encyclopedia Philadelphia Project, together with you, can help to bridge some of these suggestions to, and help support them, those that need connections among groups and individuals, those that need a basis of information and connection for tours, for example, or for school programs. We hope that can happen with us. And we'll carry your ideas directly into our website for starters, and then hopefully begin to build some content-rich resources for you and together with you. So at this point, I want to say thank you. Once again, we started with this little phrase, the green country town, and look at everywhere it took us. The encyclopedia has some slogans too. Ours are connecting the past with the present, and we certainly did that today, starting from William Penn up to the present. Building community, and I think we have done a lot of that here tonight, and creating a legacy, which is the next step for us. The next program we'll hold is on June the 23rd. Our next famous phrase is Cradle of Liberty. We'll be at the National Constitution Center on June 23rd for a fantastic panel there once again. So with that, I'm going to thank you for your participation and ask you once again to make sure you're filling out those pieces of paper for us. There'll be volunteers to take them, and across the hall there is food and drink, so please continue the conversation with us next door. Thank you, everyone.